History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they won't go untold if we do something about it before it's too late. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, of course, so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We're always educated, we're always entertained when we do this, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the years, we've heard from dozens of veterans who took part in the Battle of the Bulge, which was in its initial week 81 years ago in that infamous winter of December 1944. Many of the ex-prisoners of war we've met on Hometown Heroes over the years were captured during that 40-day engagement that cost more than 19,000 Americans their lives, saw 23,000 more taken captive, and ended up with 80,000 of the approximately 700,000 Americans involved counted as casualties. If my grandfather hadn't survived the Battle of the Bulge with the 6th Armored Division, I wouldn't be here to listen to his fellow Bulge survivors, four of whom we'll get to hear from today as we mark the 81st anniversary. In the weeks ahead, I hope to hear from a couple other veterans we've met over the years who were in Europe this past week to mark that anniversary, but let's begin today with the memories of John Parker. He was a 24-year-old newlywed when he headed overseas.
Well, it varied when... When we joined, it was getting into winter. They'd experienced, I think, that winter was the coldest they'd had in 25 years, I think. And so living out was terrible. And snow, and it was not good. The experience of combat, if people want to know, they can go to a movie and see what happens in combat. And it was tough.
Was there anything that you had done in training or anything in your life that prepared you for that feeling of the enemy shooting at you?
Well, you imagined a lot of what combat would be, but you always worried a lot about it, and of course you read about it, and you were trained even for hand-to-hand combat. We went through training in the infantry, and that's one thing that I never experienced was hand-to-hand combat. Fortunately, when we were sent down to work on the Bulge, the Germans were advancing, of course, as far as they could go. Then we moved there in the northern sector. And then it was the reverse. They had to retreat because the Allies were overpowered with not only men, but also machinery that was needed.
Well, a lot of questions come to mind because I know you faced a lot of hazards. But maybe let's start with the weather, because you mentioned how cold it was, and it's documented that was the worst winter they'd had in decades. And here you are, a guy from Arizona and California, out in feet and feet of snow. What did you have to keep you warm? How did you stay warm? How'd you survive that?
Well, we were supposed to get winter gear, and I'm not sure what that was, but it was always late coming. It's like the Army, you know, there. Uh-huh. But it was cold, and you had to live. We were outside most of the time, and I remember one night we had to move from point A to point B and spent probably 5 or 6 hours, and a whole company was out in the snow. And when you're doing that, you're not in a hurry because they have to move a little bit, and then you stand and you wait, and you're out in the snow. And the cold was terrible, really was awful. Yeah, and I had never experienced that kind of, living in southern Arizona all my life. I had nothing, no experience with snow.
Well, I'm just thinking about that and wondering how you avoided getting frostbite or having your toes turn black or losing some of your extremities. Were there some things you did to combat that?
Well, you try to keep them dry, of course, and then you need to even take your shoes and socks off if you're on a rest and you're not in combat at that time, and rub your feet. Keep the circulation going, and it helps.
And when you say the Battle of the Bulge, I mean, most people think this big, monstrous battle where thousands and thousands died, and it was tragic. But I'm sure you're just seeing a little sliver of it. Was it not until afterwards that you realized how massive an operation that was and how many guys had lost their lives, or did you see signs of that as it was unfolding?
Well, you could see part of that because we were in one sector. We were on the northern sector of the Battle of the Bulge. All the publicity and notoriety really was from where Bastogne was, and Patton trying to reach there, and they were trying to live in siege by the Germans. But it was it wasn't good.
And I've got to ask you, I know some of these things are harder to talk about than others, but you mentioned that feeling of family once you knew your outfit, you knew this platoon you're going to be with. I have to imagine that you probably had to deal with losing some of those guys who had become your family. What was that like, and how did you handle it?
Well, that's just part of life over there. You expect that. And when I joined the platoon in Geilenkirchen, the day before they had a firefight, and the fellow that I replaced, I never didn't get to know his name. But, you know, you just learn to live with the idea that you might be wounded. I remember soon after I joined the platoon, we were moving from one place to another and moving through a forest. And Germans started sending artillery in, and we had tree bursts. And that was terrible. And we had soldiers yelling and people yelling for a medic all the time. And you could hear the tree bursts, and it was pretty bad. I'd become a Christian, and we were all a Christian family. But at that time, I said, Lord, we need help here. And but I came close to, I think, just breaking, but the Lord helped me through that.
And when you talk about tree bursts, some people might not be familiar with what that means, but you're in the forest, and all those trees around you basically become additional shrapnel that these artillery shells can create and spray everywhere. So you say, and it's dark, but you hear your fellow soldiers crying out in pain, asking for medics. And what did you do? Did you keep moving? Did you hunker down? How did you avoid getting hit?
Well, don't have time, and the ground's frozen anyway because you can't dig a foxhole. No. And all you can do is just lay down, and tree bursts are terrible because when the shells hit the trees and they burst, the shrapnel can go any place. Your targets, if they're not tree bursts and they burst on the ground, then the shrapnel, none of it goes down because it's already there. So most of it has to go up or to the side. And there's always a chance that you can survive that.
But there's really nowhere to hide. And you just talked about it, what that did to you, that it almost broke you, that it brought you to a point where God was your only relief or your only outlet, the only person you could appeal to in that moment. And I don't want to harp on it and press on it and make it more than it was, but it sounds like an overwhelming moment for you that kind of is still there, that you can remember what that felt like. Can you help us understand what that felt like?
Well, you were people dying around you, people being wounded around you, all the yelling and, you know, for medic, and the medics were trying to reach everybody. And it was pretty bad. You realized that in an instant you could be gone or be wounded. But the Lord helped me through that.
And I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but is that a situation where you think about that wife back home who you were only married to for a little more than a month before the Army took you away?
Oh, yeah. You miss that. Yeah, miss being home with family, and it was hard.
A lot of guys have said, you know, they carried a photo of their wife around or, you know, something from her. Is there something you did to make it like her presence was always with you while you were over there?
Well, I had pictures of my wife and the family, too, and that always helped. And letters were great, too. Letters were wonderful. You're keeping in touch. Of course, now wherever they are, they can call home. We couldn't call home.
I'm sure you would have loved to many times. And with the Bulge specifically, you talked about being on the northern part. Was that something where it felt like it was never going to end, or could you see the progress that was being made?
Well, we had reports. And, of course, like where you are, you really don't get a lot of news. It filters down to you, but some of it's good, some of it's bad. We were hearing also of the terrible things that were happening down in Bastogne. They had the massacre down there, and people talked about that. We were doing mostly moving a lot. And then when the Bulge failed as far as the Germans were concerned, then they were on the way back because they had to reverse and go the other direction.
When you say the massacre, do you mean the Malmedy massacre when they captured the Americans and just gunned them down?
Yeah, and shot them, killed all of them. And I think probably that changed a lot of the attitude of the soldiers, too. They were saying, no more prisoners, no more prisoners, you know. Now, how often that happened, I don't know.
You're hearing them say that, and the implication is they're not going to take any chances with German prisoners. They're going to treat them the same way the Germans treated the Americans.
Yeah, I'm sure that happened, but I don't know statistics whether they really have that down as record or not. I don't know, but I'm sure it went through a lot of minds that time.
And you told us about, you know, with those tree bursts in the forest, and you said that God helped you. When you say God helped me, is that just with your own psyche and your own mindset walking through all this, or do you look back at specific moments and say, boy, that's pretty amazing that I survived, and there must have been something else going on there?
Well, yeah, I think you fear for your life. That can be in the environment that you are at the time, and all the tree bursts and all the noise and the yelling, and it was pretty bad. But you trust in the Lord, and it helped. I calmed down, and then we moved on after that.
Are there instances that you look back on and you say, that was a pretty close call? I almost that one almost had my name on it?
Oh, sure, yeah. And a lot of times, you know, your firefights, you think about that, you know. But it's a risk, and you just live with that.
Not trying to be salacious here or anything, but just to understand, what would you say is the closest that an enemy round or shell or some piece of artillery came to you?
Well, probably rifle fire that was close to me. We didn't really get a lot of artillery fire. That was one of the worst ones that I experienced. But we did have experiences, I remember, and this was back to snow again. We were going, the hill was in front of us, and that night I was chosen to be on a patrol to go up and see at the top of there if there was any Germans up there. So we did, and crawled up. We could hear the Germans talking, and then we went back and reported. Then the next morning, we had one tank with us, and he started up, and then we were out flanked on both sides. And when we got there, the Germans were gone. But we didn't know that, of course. I think people would like to get behind the tank, you know.
Yeah, and it's hard to blame them. And when you say the rifle fire came close, are we talking a couple feet? Are we talking a couple inches? How close do you think it came to you?
Probably within feet, yeah, close enough. And you hear a lot. And when we ran across the tank destroyer unit there in Germany, he says, there's a German Tiger down there, and he's firing at him. I heard one shot, but they were terrible. You could hear those go by. It was pretty bad.
I have to imagine you heard the 88s a time or two, too, huh?
Yeah, heard 88s. And they're terrible sounds, you know. Yeah, it was bad.
You're not a very old guy at this point, by our understanding today. See, if you're born in 1919 and this is December of 44, you're 25 years old?
25 years old.
And you're probably an old man compared to the guys around you.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're 25, there's probably some 18, 19, 20-year-olds around.
Yeah. And when I moved in with the company and the platoon that I joined, yeah, I was older. I was the fellow and I went to school with in France. He was staff sergeant. I was buck sergeant. I had three stripes. He had four. I think that I had replaced somebody, I think the day before, had been wounded or killed, and I was a replacement.
So this is from the office of the commanding general of the 84th Infantry Division, the Rail Splitters, Sergeant John M. Parker, 333rd Infantry, United States Army, for heroic service in connection with military operations against the enemy in Belgium, 15-16 January 1945. Although exhausted from a previous patrol during which he had gained accurate and vital information concerning the enemy, Sergeant Parker guided another patrol to the enemy positions. Encountering heavy enemy fire, Sergeant Parker, without regard for his own safety, routed the enemy from their foremost position and captured two prisoners. Shortly thereafter, Sergeant Parker captured three additional Germans. The courage, initiative, and aggressiveness displayed by Sergeant Parker contributed much to the success of his company's operations and are in accordance with the finest traditions of the military service. So that's what the general said about it. I want to hear it in your version.
We had received information that there were somebody out there, and so the lieutenant in the platoon designated the three of us, the staff sergeant, myself, and another fella, and we went out on patrol, and we had a firefight with them. There were two that we encountered, and we got in a firefight with them. They were both wounded. I don't think any of our patrol was wounded at all. One was severely wounded, and then one we took back, practically carried him back because he was a source of information, and they wanted to interview him and talk to him. But the other one was not, he didn't make it, but we did save one.
And that was the first patrol or the second?
That was the second patrol.
But you had gone out the night before, and the citation describes you as being exhausted from that. Can you put into words how exhausted or what that's like? I mean, did you get any rest?
Of course, you don't get much rest anyway. When you're out on the line, you know, you're in foxholes, and you don't get a lot of rest. And so then you'd been out in your tents because you're out on patrol. That's what he's referring to, that we were mentally strained and also physically tired.
So then they asked you to go back out, or you volunteered to go back out?
They asked us to go back out. Not supposed to volunteer.
I've heard a lot of guys say that, never volunteer for anything in the Army. That's the first rule. So when they say, we want you to go back there and take us to where you were, is there part of you that doesn't want to do that?
Not really, but you do what they say.
And how many guys were with you?
There was only three of us.
So there's three of you, and it says that you led them back to that enemy position, and you routed the enemy, and then you captured two prisoners, and then you captured three more. So it sounds like they had you outnumbered.
Well, they did. But I don't know why that happened, but it did. It was hard. And I don't think we didn't get wounded at all. But we had fired at these two in the second patrol and wounded both of those.
Were you firing at some others, too, that were in the area that probably ran away? Or?
Well, no. I don't know why. There was only two people there. Maybe they had had a firefight someplace else.
Well, and then it says that on the way back you encountered three more? And they just surrendered to you, or what?
No, I don't understand that whole thing there. But when we got the two, the other ones, that had happened before that. But then when the last two we had, and we had a firefight with them, and then we brought one of them back.
And that sure sounds like a situation where it was going to either be you or them.
Yeah, it would. You're out in the woods, middle of the woods, nobody's around. Whoever gets the fire done right wins, and that's what happened.
Is there an emotional or mental weight that comes along with that situation when you realize that the bullets you guys were firing claimed the life of an enemy?
That was. And you always think about when didn't make it. You always wonder about him. He's somebody else, you know, fighting a war, has a family. You think about those things.
The late John Parker, who survived the Battle of the Bulge with the 84th Infantry Division. He shared those memories when he was 98. It's time for our first break, but when we come back to this special episode marking the 81st anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge, more memories from the worst winter Europe had ever seen, and a pivotal point in the Allied victory in Europe. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 81st anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge this week by listening to memories of four men who experienced it all firsthand. When I met Paul Davis years ago in South Bend, Indiana, there was plenty of snow on the ground, but nowhere near what he had dealt with in Bastogne, Belgium in December 1944.
The one that I had nightmares over, I was going to headquarters to pick up my lieutenant. This was at night. We just had them little cat eyes on the Jeep to drive by. I was going along, and all of a sudden, it was bright. Couldn't see nothing. So I stopped, and I heard water running. And I had come to a bridge that had been bombed out. And I had another 6 feet, and I had been into the Moselle River.
Wow.
And what had happened was somebody had went through and must have hit the barricades and moved them. But I was just lucky that I stopped when I did.
Wow. That's close enough for me.
Yep. And I had a nightmare one night, and I was in my sleeping bag, and I went to open it up, and boy, I just burnt my arms with that zipper.
You had a nightmare flashing back to the Jeep and the river?
Going into the river, yes.
Sure.
That was
understandable.
That was the closest call.
Was there a time pressure or urgency associated with repairing all these different weapons?
No, some of them we couldn't repair, and we'd have to replace them. We cannibalized a lot combination. If the front end was bad on one, well, we could take one that the back end was and make one good vehicle out of it.
Uh-huh.
That was the automotive section. I had nothing to do with that section.
You were just with the artillery.
Right.
And was it pretty much the same thing over and over again, or did you have some unique challenges with different weapons that you had to figure out a way to solve?
Well, sometimes we had a priority gun that had to be right away or something. We'd work all night or something to get it done. Time meant nothing to us then.
And how did you feel about that job? I mean, everybody that I talk to says, you know, I didn't do anything important. Those guys over there, those are the guys you should talk to. But it just occurs to me that you were doing something pretty important.
Well, I'm just thankful I could do it and got through it the way I did.
Did you feel that other guys' lives depended on you?
Yes.
Because those guns are designed to take lives.
Right.
But having them operational could save a lot of American lives.
Right. That's the way we won the war.
I guess this is maybe another master of the obvious question. But if you're around all these guns, and you said from a 45, a handheld pistol, all the way to a 155, the biggest piece of artillery that we were trucking around Europe, there's a lot in between there, but they all have one thing in common. They make a lot of noise.
Right.
So and how are your ears?
Well, I can still hear pretty good, but I notice lately my hearing is getting worse. The fellow at the VA couldn't believe that I still had much hearing as I had being in the field artillery.
Well, I'm having a hard time believing it, too, because I've talked to so many guys who didn't, and I'm guessing you didn't have any protection for your ears, right?
We had earplugs.
Yeah.
On your right side of one of them guns, when they go off, they're pretty loud. Doesn't sound like you've got earplugs.
When you had to take it back to the artillery section, which typically is going to be behind the infantry, but when you had to go up there and actually fire that gun, did that feel different than what you were doing the rest of the time?
Yes.
How so?
Well, you never knew. If you made a mistake, that was it. So just thankful I never made a mistake.
One might assume, given the nature of your duties, that you didn't get shot at a lot. Is that accurate?
Yes and no. When we were up there, there was the German artillery coming in at us.
How close?
Too close at times. And just lucky that we didn't get hit with shrapnel.
Was there something that kept you going? Maybe helped you get through those days where you weren't sure if you were going to make it back?
No, we just had a job to do and we did it.
And you brought up the Battle of the Bulge. And something tells me when the weather's like it is right now here in South Bend, I was driving through snow all the way to get here, and Christmas rolls around, something tells me you probably think back to 1944.
Yes, I do. And where we were at in the Bulge, we had about 6 feet of snow.
You were in Belgium.
And we were surrounded.
Were you in and around Bastogne?
Yes.
And what kind of accommodations did you have there?
We had our sleeping bags. And it wasn't there, but when we were in the town of Metz, we slept in a bombed-out railroad station. The roof was off, and we slept on a marble floor, and we had a whole bunch of newspaper and blankets underneath us, and it was still cold.
I bet. Well, and you've lived in South Bend your whole life. You guys get a fair amount of snow here. You know what winter's like.
Right.
Is there a difference between that and what you dealt with in that winter of 44?
Not really, except when we were in the Battle of the Bulge, and that was deep snow.
And did you guys have shelter? Or were you in a foxhole? Where were you sleeping at night?
Sleeping anywhere we could. find any shelter. A lot of times it was in somebody's home or something that they had evacuated. So once in a while we were lucky enough to find a place that had a fireplace we could build a fire.
A lot of guys I've talked to who are in that neck of the woods have talked about frozen feet, getting numb hands, noses. Right. Did you deal with any of that?
Yes. There was about 6 weeks where I never had dry socks.
So what happened to your feet?
They were cold and numb and stuff, but I come out of it all right.
Kept all your toenails?
Yes.
And when you say you were surrounded, you knew that?
Yes.
How'd that make you feel?
Very unhappy.
How long did that last before you realized you were in the clear and you had basically been liberated by your fellow Americans?
We were probably in there probably a week.
Did you have anything to eat?
Very little, K rations.
And you're freezing your tail off?
Yes.
What was going through your mind?
We just wonder when the end was coming.
Were you prepared for that, the possibility that that might be the end?
Well, we figured that from the time we landed in France. We never knew when our number was going to be up. Mm-hmm. And you just live with that in mind.
Have you ever, well, I'm sure you've read all about all the different fronts of the Bulge and everything that was going on there and the thousands of Americans who died there. Mm-hmm. How should those guys be remembered?
Well, they gave everything. They gave their life. To me, that was everything. Some of them had families that were left, mm-hmm. and it was hard.
And did you witness any of that, or were you insulated from the death and destruction there?
Well, we seen some of it, not a whole lot. We did see quite a bit.
Enough to know.
Yes.
A few months later, he would see even more jarring things when his unit passed through a concentration camp. That was the late Paul Davis. And now we get to hear from Daniel Langpap, who had become a college baseball and football player after World War II, despite the frozen feet he suffered during the Battle of the Bulge.
Well, I can remember several days before it started, and I want to relate to this, that somebody had to be out on guard duty every night. This one particular night, of course, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was so dark. And we had the anti-tank gun dug in and two kind of bunkers that we had that we could sleep in, because the unit before us, which happened to be the a unit of the 1st Infantry Division, had dug down and then it cut some logs and put on top and then a little dirt, so we were underground. But the gun was out in the open for protecting a sort of an intersection. So I was out one night. I was on midnight to 8, which is a long time, but you're not doing anything anyway. So you're really just standing around looking at nothing because you can't see. 8 o'clock in the morning, what sun there was, or the light came. The sun was now, but the light came. And all around me was a bunch of footprints in the snow, like somebody had been around scouting us out but left us alone. So you know who that would have been, of course. And that sort of got our hackles up a little bit. And then a couple of days later, all of this started early one morning. We had moved our gun to another location, and we were kind of pinned down where we couldn't move, but we were standing in a slushy water up to our knees for about 8 hours. We couldn't get out and just stood there in that without any, you know, no overshoes at all. So got so cold you couldn't feel your feet in anyway. And then we were able to get away from that. We had a chance to move back a little bit, and our kitchen was about a mile behind us because, believe it or not, we had hot meals every day up until that time, although we had K rations and C rations too. And a mortar shell had dropped in our kitchen area and killed all of our cooks and destroyed the kitchen, so we were on regular rations after that. We just made it out, and then we weren't directly in contact with the enemy for a while, although you could hear buzz bombs going over on their way to England. They came every so often, and they were really a noisy thing. I didn't know later on until when I was back in England in a hospital that they were still shooting these things over, and I did see a couple of them, but not in our area of London. That is pretty much the way things were at the start, and most people don't realize that even though the Battle of the Bulge was such a horrific thing, that it really didn't last very long. It was about, what, about a month, really, wasn't it? Before it was
40 days or so, yeah. Well, let's talk about you and your feet. And you mentioned that early on, you guys being the anti-tank unit, were able to have dugouts to build some kind of shelter for the snow. When did that end? When did you find yourself out on your own in the snow, really with no shelter, no way to keep warm?
Just about immediately. And I was referring to that time where we could not move for an eight-hour period, and you're in. That started the problem with me. A week later, I was able to take my shoes off. Now, people find out it's kind of hard to believe that you couldn't even change your clothes, any part of it, for weeks at a time. They say, yuck, you know. But that's the way it was. And so I was able to get to a fire, and my feet were itching, like itching inside of, itching where you can't scratch them. And so I warmed them up at a fire, and they just ballooned. I couldn't get my shoes back on. And so that effectively took me out of the war for the time being. And I was shipped back to a hospital in Viviers, Belgium, and then a hospital train on to through Paris to Le Havre. And we had a channel steamer, hospital ship, British hospital ship, back to England. And then eventually ended up at a big hospital plant in Carmarthen, Wales. And the amazing thing about that trip across on the Channel hospital steamer was the fact that as rough as the English Channel is usually, you know, it's usually the water was glass smooth. There wasn't a ripple. And that was amazing to me because usually the English Channel is very, very rough. One of the breakfasts we had on board was cold sweetened tea and cold boiled eggs. I guess that's the English way of doing it. But the crew was very nice to us when we went.
I got to ask you, when you're taken off the line because your feet are frozen and you really can't get around anymore, are you relieved that you know you're not going to be as much in harm's way? Are you kind of remorseful that you can't be there with these guys you've been serving with? What was your mindset at the time?
When they took me back to the aid station the first time and the doctor looked at my feet and said, well, you can't stay around here. It was evening time and they put me off in a tent all by myself. And, man, I felt just awful. You know, I said, man, all my pals, we'd played softball together. And all of a sudden, I wasn't there anymore. But, I felt remorse. But then again, I felt not so concerned about standing out in all that lousy weather again. It was mainly the weather that was so bad. Because it's amazing at the time that young people, and see, I was 19 years old at the time, that they don't think they can get hurt. Invincible, just like the kids now driving cars. You know, they get in that thing, nothing's ever going to happen to them. And sadly, it does. And sadly, it did then. And the boys over in Iraq, the part that really, really bothers me, you know, is getting shot is one thing, but getting blown up is something else. I can't even picture roadside bombs as a part of war.
Because it's so cowardly?
Oh, it's a cowardly, dastardly act, but that's just the way they do.
Well, and in your case, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you talk about chances of survival. Did you ever, either then or maybe in all the years since, look back and say, maybe having frozen feet actually saved my life? Maybe that was the best thing that ever happened to me?
Well, I would say it probably did, although I wasn't thinking of it at the time. Another thing that and we all kind of laughed about this was before we left Camp Maxey to go ahead towards Boston and overseas, that we all had to make out our wills. And my mom, I remember, she died in 1968, and she'd given me all this packet of stuff she'd had for years that I'd sent home. My last will and testament. Now, you know, we never thought, why do we need this for?
You're 19 years old, and you're making out a will.
Yeah, we're just going over there for maybe a year, and we're coming back home, and that's it. Doesn't work out that way. But I was thinking that with that will, if I hadn't gotten it back before I got married and something happened to it, they would have everything and my wife would have nothing. So we've laughed about that too. So I tore that rascal up.
I know you don't want to complain about it or aren't looking for an overwhelming amount of sympathy or anything, but just so our listeners understand what this has meant in your life. Having frozen feet is not something that just happened then and went away. This is something you've had to live with since. What have been the after effects and the lingering effects of what you endured at the Battle of the Bulge?
The after effects of the frozen feet meant that they've had some sort of achy feeling practically my whole life. Of course, they were not considered a battle injury at the time. And not until when the Korean vets were complaining because they went through the same thing, only probably maybe a little worse because it went for a longer period of time. And they got some, Congress finally came through with something for them. And then someone spoke up that, well, how about the World War II vets? So I wrote up a letter and sent it in. Eventually I got an answer. And they said, well, come in, let us look at you. And then they assigned me to a doctor downtown for a physical examination. And I went down there, and they had me standing in buckets of water with ice in them, you know. And a strange thing happened, and I didn't realize this, that I would stand in this water for about 5 minutes, which really did not feel too well. But it affected the foot that wasn't in the water at the same time. And then I'd change it and vice versa. He said, this is just something that happens. And so I forgot all about it. A letter came. This letter came about 3 days before Christmas. And it was there. And I hadn't even opened it up because I get stuff from the VA all the time. And so my wife said, well, why don't you take a look at this? And so I opened it up on Christmas Day. And said that I was going to get 60% disability. Kind of a nice Christmas present. Anyway.
Better late than never, right? It's time for our final break. But when we come back, one more Battle of the Bulge survivor who was decorated for saving the life of a fellow soldier. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remembering the Battle of the Bulge this week, 81 years after it began in a frozen European continent. Paul Ferdinandsson was a college track star before and after his time with the 84th Infantry Division, The after part of that equation might sound more impressive after you hear what he went through in uniform.
It's unbelievable. When we pulled back on Thanksgiving, we reorganized in Geilenkirchen and were moved to another sector. The war was, at that point, was just kind of stagnant. The Germans made that attack in the Bulls, and we were down there before the Germans ever got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another story in itself, really, because this happened right at Christmas time. But it was a miracle. They get word. They've lined up trucks behind a few miles, and we were another new unit over from the United States filled our foxholes. We were pulled back, got into those trucks, were instructed what to do in case German planes attacked us, and that was our entrance into the Battle of the Bulge. We were deployed to stop their advance on the 19th, which was pretty wonderful how quickly our military reacted to it.
Even if you were one of the guys who might have to pay with it.
Oh, yeah.
Pay for it with your life, and you came close a few more times.
Yeah.
And there were some more harrowing moments that you've recounted about those days, and some of them involve seeing some of your buddies wounded, and you even got to the point where you put your life on the line to try to save his, evacuating a wounded buddy with guns firing at you.
That was 26th of December. We'd made the attack on the 24th.
Hard to forget that Christmas, huh?
Yeah.
Do you find yourself every Christmas thinking back to those
days? Oh, yeah. A lot of times at night, I wake up 2, 3 o'clock, and I'm awake for about several hours almost every night, and much of that time is spent reliving those experiences, post-traumatic stress disorder. I got that real bad right at the end. I'd always led all the attacks, and I felt that was my job, and I did it. But right there towards the end, the rumors spread that our division was going to be sent back and then going to be in on an invasion of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I tell you. In the evenings, I'd go out there, the tears would just roll down my cheeks.
Wow.
Because I didn't know if I could lead anymore. I felt I might just go to pieces.
Well, it takes a toll, huh? And you'd seen other guys go to pieces, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And tell me about the circumstance. I believe it was a fellow soldier named Hank who had been wounded pretty badly on his backside.
Oh, yeah, on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
There was a German tank in that small town, Verdun. Name of the town is Verdun.
Right.
It's a village, and it's rolling country, and Verdun is kind of on top of one of the rises on the ridge there. We attacked on Christmas Eve. Again, that was a sniff. I don't know if we should bother leading up to this attack, but it was supposed to take place about 8 o'clock in the evening, but we didn't attack until around 11. There was a three-hour gap because of a big screw-up. Anyway, we went through the town. I'd instructed the squad leaders to go independently through town as fast as they could go, because we were supposed to dig in on the far side, dig foxholes, and then another unit's supposed to come through and take the town, because the Germans had just kicked out Americans who had that town the day before. It's a fairly important strategic place town. We were to take it back. There was a German tank in the main drag, about the only street in town. Hank got shot in the butt. I always claimed that if he didn't have such a big butt, he would have missed him.
Sure, he appreciated that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he always felt I saved his life, but that's not true. I just helped. The rest of our company was supposed to have taken the town within minutes after we went through and dug in. We'd done our job.
Right.
Now you're supposed to come in and take the town. Well, they never showed up. And I thought, uh-oh, this is Thanksgiving all over again. I sent two guys back to find out what the screw-up was. Well, they never came back. So I asked another fellow.
Waldron Dyer?
Waldron Dyer. Said if he'd go up for a little excitement, him and I were going to try to get through town. We got up. A German soldier shot point blank at us. Could have been more than a few feet away. And we had left our packs and all that stuff behind belts and shot at him. And then we ducked between these two houses. Got up to the street, and the Germans knew we were there somewhere, thought maybe we'd gone into the house, and they were yelling at us to surrender. So we got to the edge of the town, and he asked me, I don't have any bullets left in my rifle. So we decided, well, we better get back. So we sneaked back to the edge of the house and then sprinted to where we had dug our foxhole and a bunch of hedgerows around there. I said, well, this is all screwed up, and I'm going to go back by myself this time. And I snuck the same way, just said to myself, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, go. Because it's scary, you know, because I don't know, the German might be guns pointed at me. But I didn't go. So I did it the second time. I sprinted, probably broke a couple of records of getting across the street to a church yard, and got back, and our company was on the edge of the other edge of town. I asked, well, what happened? He said, well, the captain said, we had too many casualties from our own, which we had walked partially through too.
Artillery?
Our mortars, basically what it was. So we think we had enough men, and I thought to myself, bolt. They had enough guys. They just chose not to go any further. So I went, found out what was going on, went back, and then now we get to Altman. The word comes that we got to get Hank Altman out of here because he's in bad shape. Our aid man, Gibson, we call him Doc, he dug a shallow trench and laid Altman in it, but then he came to me the next evening. It happened on Christmas Day night, that Hank was getting worse and worse. We had to get him evacuated somehow. So I picked two guys to carry rifles, and another guy and I would carry Hank Altman. And so I'd been through the town once before. We got to the same spot and sent the two riflemen sprinting across to that spot that I'd pointed out, told them that they got shot at or shot, that we weren't coming. We would just not try to bother because carrying somebody is pretty slow.
Yeah.
But they got across, and then carrying Altman, he had his arms around our neck, and we dragged and moved as fast as we could across that street.
Did anyone fire at you guys while you were dragging them across?
No.
You got them there?
Yeah, no. And the Germans just stayed bottled up, the four of us, and we came back to the platoon. We had two platoons up there. It was a third platoon, us, and fourth platoon. And during that time, there was a two-story house behind the fourth platoon. They could look down into our foxholes a little bit, and they shot through the head two or three guys. And, of course, we got word in a hurry, do something. So I had guys punch their rifles between some hedges and then shoot into that upstairs and intermittently just fire in there. Mm-hmm. And they never shot again then.
And you're painting a picture for us of how chaotic and insane this becomes. And I'm trying to imagine being you. And it's from one thing to the next. It's, well, these guys are taking pot shots at us from up there. We got to take care of that. You're evacuating a wounded buddy and saving his life and getting back to Hank. So you guys get him where he needed to go, and they evacuate him further from there to a field hospital. But at that point, you probably have no idea whether he's going to make it or not, huh?
Mm-mm.
When did you find out?
It had to have been after the war was over. Maybe he got my address and sent a Christmas card or something. But anyway, we made contact, and we kept in close contact. And he passed away a couple of years ago with cancer.
But you got to see him again after the war at a reunion.
Quite a few times, yeah.
What did he tell you?
I saved his life.
How'd that make you feel?
Well, I felt kind of embarrassed by it. I said, I didn't think your life was saved just by getting back to a good field hospital somewhere.
You had a hand in that, and you risked your life to do it.
Yeah, I did that. But.
And the bulge wasn't over on December 26th. You guys had a few more weeks, and the weather wasn't getting any better. How bad were those conditions, and what was the worst that you dealt with, and how frustrated were you with the rubber shoe selection?
Yeah, well, that's nothing I could do about it. So my feet were soaking wet.
You're a size 11.
Yeah,
but the biggest
24 hours a day.
The biggest rubber shoes they had to go over your boots were size 10.
Size 10.
So you were on your own.
Yeah. So all I had was leather shoes. You know, they got soaking wet, and that's why my feet froze and turned black.
Where'd you guys sleep?
Out in the open in the woods.
In the snow.
In the snow. Yeah.
Digging a foxhole in frozen, icy ground.
Sometimes we'd say the hell with it. We wouldn't even bother digging a foxhole. We just get behind a tree, and during that time, I had a kind of a raincoat, or kick snow away, then lay down the raincoat, and then take my soaking wet shoes and socks. I had another pair of socks that I could change, and we wore overcoats. We had to have something, or we'd be freeze to death standing up. And then lay down on that, and just sheer exhaustion, you'd fall sound asleep for a short while, and then you have to get up and stomp your feet again. And I would sleep with my soaking wet shoes on my belly as I kind of curl around the shoes and kind of get them to dry out a little bit.
So day after day of combat during the day and fighting the elements overnight.
Overnight. We were supposed to have scouts out because the Germans might attack us during the night. That's when I took it upon myself to ignore that. I said, they're not going to be going out here in this crap. I put a scout out maybe 2 trees away from us, just maybe not more than 20 feet. Okay, you're the scout now in case anybody says this is where you were put on duty.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody ever checked. Like I said, I led all the attacks. And we basically, just huge skirmish lines, just moved east. The Germans would stop in small villages or certain spots where were easier to defend and take us on for a short while, and then they would take off because then we'd bring in mortars and stuff. And the bolts lasted close to a month.
And what a heavy price was paid, and certainly all those who didn't come home, and that number was astronomical, but... You did come home, and you came home with physical and mental and emotional scars. You told us about the nightmares that you've had. How bad did your feet get? Can you give us a sense of what that was like then and what you've had to live with since?
Well, I was in the field hospital right at the end of the bulge, and I could have played that game, and I would never have had to go back.
Because your feet were black. They were frozen, frostbitten, no feeling.
No, they hurt.
You could feel the pain.
Very painful. Kind of a little sideline there. The general of our division came by that little field hospital, and he stopped and asked me, how you feeling, son? Or I think he called me son. And I said, I'm doing just fine, sir. And tears, I mean, I got tears in my eye. He got tears in his eyes and said, I don't know how you boys can stand it. I was there, I think, 3 days. Then I got survivor's guilt. I felt real guilty that I'm back here on my butt on a canvas stretcher, and they're out there in those dang snow, still fighting against the Germans. So I asked, how about letting me go and going back? If you want to go, go ahead. So I went right back, finished out the war, which ended for us on the Elbe River. We're about 35 miles from Berlin, where we met with the Russians. Actually, this is getting way ahead of everything. I think the American armies could have walked into Berlin and taken it. The Germans would have been very happy because the Russians were just boring in on them from the east.
They didn't want the Russians taking everything
they
over.
They knew what was going to happen if the Russians took over.
Yeah.
Because they had treated the Russians pretty brutally when they were invading Russia.
Yep.
And they knew they were going to get the same medicine.
I keep harping on your feet, and you would get the Purple Heart because of what happened to your feet throughout those brutal conditions of the bulge. What about in all the years since? Do they bother you? Do you have lingering effects of that?
Yes, I really believe that my feet have given me a little problem ever since. I mean, they'll ache, and especially my big toe. It bothered some, but not to the point where I feel I'm crippled.
I know I'm jumping way ahead here, but I'm thinking about your coaching career, and I've interviewed some other guys over the years who fought in World War II and went on to be highly successful coaches. And you finished up at Fresno State after the war. We're throwing javelin for Coach Hanner there on the Bulldog track team, and did some coaching up and down the San Joaquin Valley, and now here in the Silicon Valley, the first coach at Cupertino High School. And, I mean, just hundreds of guys who played for you over the years. There's a lot of players who think they have it rough, think you're tough on them. They have things to complain about.
Yeah.
Did you ever use any of your war stories to put that in perspective for them and say they don't know anything?
No, I really didn't. I know I would speak about the experiences in class. I taught health education and Escalon.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, just to break the routine, I'd go into a war story. And once they heard them once or twice, another war story. They'd heard enough.
Well, I know the people that listen to this program can't get enough, and they're probably in awe, as I am, of some of the situations that you endured. And now that you've had the lens of history to look back, to see the bigger picture of everything that was happening in Europe, the magnitude of the Battle of the Bulge, its significance, and the bigger war, knowing how many Americans died, You think about all those close calls you had. How fortunate do you feel that you survived it all?
I'm pretty lucky because I believe Americans lost 15,000 dead.
The official government records now say more than 19,000 Americans paid the ultimate price during the Battle of the Bulge. I hope the four men we heard from today gave you a better idea of what it was like to be there. And as I mentioned earlier, a couple of our previous guests on Hometown Heroes were back in Europe this week. Perhaps we'll have a chance to update their stories and hear what that journey was like. Some of you are well into Hanukkah celebrations, others like my family gearing up for Christmas. And as we close this episode, just a reminder that so many Americans can't be home for the holidays because they're protecting us all around the globe. Say an extra prayer for them when you gather, will you? I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.